Welcome to the Defense and Aerospace Report podcast. I'm your host, Vagha Maradian. Our podcast is brought to you by Bell. Since 1935, Bell has been redefining flight. Learn more about its pioneering spirit at bellflight.com. Later in the program, Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council on Iran. But first, joining us is George Rumford, the Principal Deputy Director for the Defense Department's Test Resource Management Center that plays a critical role in developing America's next generation weaponry, whether it is hypersonics, directed energy, autonomous systems, electronic warfare, and even nuclear weapons. He also oversees the nation's cyber test range complexes, including the National Cyber Range Complex. George, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Vago. Appreciate the opportunity to talk about DoD test infrastructure.
Absolutely, because without you guys, we don't end up with the capabilities ultimately that we need as a nation, as well with our allies and partners, which you support as well. Before we get started, our global coverage is sponsored by Leonardo DRS. Northrop Grumman sponsors our weekly cyber report and our cyber coverage overall. Fincantieri Marinette Marine sponsors our naval coverage. General Atomics Aeronautical Systems sponsors our coverage of strategy, and Beretta USA sponsors our land warfare coverage. Investment in the infrastructure, especially in the test and evaluation side of things, there's no malice in it, but unfortunately it's an infrastructure that we tend to underinvest in. So whenever cuts have to be made, it's like, well, you know, we could do a little bit less here. Let's trim our sheets. And eventually we find out that we may not have the capabilities in as robust a fashion as we need, especially at a time when the nation expects the entire development complex to work faster. This new administration obviously is looking at a large investment in national infrastructure, and we've seen that on the nuclear side, we've fallen short. We've seen at shipyards, right? Former Navy Secretary Richard Spencer used to talk about how roofs at shipyards, if they were repaired, would actually increase throughput meaningfully. First, let's start. Is the current test and evaluation infrastructure up to the challenge we face to develop this new generation of weaponry?
Well, as we look at new weapons, we're going to have to make improvements in our test infrastructure. As you highlighted, test infrastructure isn't something that the department, desires to invest in, but it's a necessary capability to have to really understand how well things work. And the example you just gave of, shipbuilding, shipyards, and the decay of them, it's very akin to the test infrastructure community. And it's always a challenge when you're having to face, budget decisions, and folks can make arguments of, we were able to survive with the capability last year, so can't we survive with the capability one more year? And that's kind of how our organization came into being, to work with each of the services to do that forecast of what do we really need in the department, and let's make those compelling arguments so that senior leaders can understand the investment and the return on that investment, and recognizing that it doesn't just happen overnight, that these are kind of seed corns that need to be invested in that are really going to enable the department to modernize and revolutionize the capabilities we deliver our warfighter.
So what's, just to put this in perspective for folks, right? I mean, we know that it's about $750 or $740 billion. What part of that is the test and evaluation infrastructure on an annual basis? And sort of where are we now? And what are the kind of investments that we need to make as a nation so that we have those capabilities to develop the systems that we need?
Well, as you know, a good portion of the department's budget is spent on operations and other aspects beyond modernization. But to answer your question specifically, where does it fall under T&E? On a rough average, the test and evaluation for the department is in the neighborhood of about $10 billion a year. Of that, about $3.5 billion goes into infrastructure, and in the neighborhood of about $1 billion. Depending on the year, is spent in to improve and modernize. And that's a key focus of our organization, is how is that, $3.5 billion spent to sustain what we currently have? And then what are we doing to modernize for the future so that we're ready with the next generation of weapons systems?
I know I'm not asking this question of a disinterested bystander, right? But how much is what we're spending enough to the task? Because a lot of our test and evaluation facilities are not spring chickens. Let's just put it mildly, right? I mean, despite your best efforts to keep them as current and the service's best efforts to keep them current, right? How much money do we need to be spending for them to be as capable as we need them to be?
That gets into a process question. It really gets into a risk question of how much risk do you want to take with inadequate test capabilities that that doesn't enable the testing that you really need to know. It's how much unknown do you want to deliver to the warfighter in your weapon systems? And so that's why our focus when we work with the services, we very much focus on what are the highest priorities? What are the biggest risk areas? What are the things that we most need to characterize for decision makers and what weapons to buy and ultimately to the warfighter on how well the weapon systems are going to work? So there isn't just a binary answer of this right. amount of money makes it all happen. It's more of a continuum, and it's the focus on how do we prioritize that continuum of what needs to be invested.
So how would you characterize your priorities now, right? I mean, where would, you know, if you're putting the money, where does the money need to go given the demand?
Well, and that's where the National Defense Strategy and defense planning guidance is so essential to our mission, because that really helps us forecast where is the department going. If the department is committed to hypersonic weapons, then we need to have the test infrastructure to do that. And so you'll see that our investments in test infrastructure very much align as you would expect it to be, where the department wants to modernize most and fastest. So it's hypersonics, directed energy, cyber, electronic warfare, nuclear modernization, autonomy, artificial intelligence, multi-domain integration, all those things that you hear about how warfare is going to be in the future is where we're putting our test dollars.
One of the major challenges that we have, right? I mean, once upon a time we could shield. I always love talking to the Cold War generation about this, about the lengths to which we would go to identify when Soviet satellites were coming over or Chinese satellites. And, you know, you would do test evolutions to make sure that you didn't get caught out and people weren't observing you, as well as detectors outside bases so that nobody could take pictures and the like. Whereas now we're in a much more ubiquitous information environment, right? It's much easier for China to eavesdrop on us, whether it's electronically or visually or from space or otherwise, increasing the demand to create these synthetic range, really high fidelity, synthetic multi-domain test ranges. Are we making enough investment on that? And are you satisfied with the progress we're making to try to get some of these capabilities on the electronic side, or at least on the digital design testing side, to a point where we can actually do some of these large scale tests away from prying eyes?
So I would never summarize my disposition as I'm satisfied where we're at. We definitely need to change the landscape, the strategy, the processes, and the tools we use to accelerate acquisition and get capabilities to the warfighter faster. So we're not doing good enough as is. We must do better. We do have strategies of how to do better and approaches need to take. Synthetic environments isn't a new thing. The department started synthetic environment strategies back in the 90s. The motivations kind of shifted. In the early days, it was all about, if we just did everything synthetic, everything will magically be cheaper. And after Cold War 1.0, it was all about how can we make the Department of Defense as affordable as possible. And now there's more recognition that the value that synthetic environments bring to the table that you're highlighting, not only in the speed of acquisition, understanding how well things perform, if we can create a synthetic environment that is realistic and based upon the physics of the problem, as well as it gives us a new dimension of security and protection in those environments. It also aligns to the trend of how systems have shifted to software-based systems. And so that also opens up the opportunity for synthetic environment.
How do we do real testing when people are watching us, right? Because at the end of the day, we also often find, right? I mean, in flight testing, increasingly the flight test is actually validating the electronic model at the end of the day. And every once in a while we find, well, wait a minute, the flight test is not validating the model and the model was wrong and the airplane or the aerostructure behaves in a different fashion, right? We didn't realize it would work that way. How do we do this in an right, in a monitored environment, how do you do some of this testing to accomplish your test aims without giving the game away?
Right, understood. And just a teaser on your phrase of real testing, we always view that all tests are real. There's always an element of it that's synthetic unless you're actually in combat. So and that's really the discussion of what do we make artificial? And that's the heart of the questions you're asking, which is at some points we need to do tests in an environment of an open air range environment that is extremely easy for our competitors to monitor and to do data collection off of. And we're very cognizant of the vulnerabilities of data collection that can occur in these open air range environments. And then you can do, you know, testing that is still legitimate testing, but it is with more constraints artificial. You can do, you know, indoor testing, ground testing, laboratory testing in anechoic chambers. And then ultimately you can try to simulate and create an artificial synthetic environment. But if you're testing the real software of the system, and if you can have software emulation of the hardware to the point that the software doesn't care, and that's really the game changing in the private sector that we track so much. If you look at the trends in the commercial space, they've gone to, you know, software based virtualized environments, and that's really our trend. And unfortunately, sometimes the Department of Defense boldly goes where everybody else has gone before. And that's kind of in some ways, the trend that we have in the test environment. I think that's kind of a stigma that one of the downfalls and one of the mindsets that we have to overcome in the department, in the T&E community, is a lot of things are done by tradition. A lot of things trace back to, well, you know, if I'm going to be testing this new missile, how did we test missiles in the 60s and the 70s? But that environment's very different and the technology is very different. And it's so much more software based that we really need to understand things that we didn't need to worry about back in the 60s and 70s, like cyber vulnerabilities of our system. So we very much are looking and recognizing that these virtual environments and these synthetic environments bring a whole new set of tools to the toolbox that are going to really change things. But that ultimately doesn't mean classic live testing goes away. It's just that the use of that tool, that live test tool, is used in a different strategy, and it's done with a risk matrix that while doing this live test, we may be revealing a capability to our competitors, that, and we need to understand that what that reveal entails.
Do you? You know, you mentioned cyber. You oversee the cyber range complexes as well. And we're finding that even cutting edge weapon systems have been that there may have been penetrations on some of these systems. And it's a very, very long list of even highly classified capabilities that have been compromised. So I don't mean this in a bad way to ask that question, right? But I mean, if high priority systems have been compromised, then there's a danger that other elements of the infrastructure have been compromised, as we saw in the solar winds, although there hasn't been any confirmation on classified information on that front yet. How are you confident that your cyber ranges, which arguably are some of our most important capabilities, right? I mean, not just from a SCADA standpoint, an operating system standpoint, but that you guys also do a lot of research and support other capabilities as well across government that are important. Are you confident that you have the level of security required to do some of this work at these ranges?
So the challenges of cyber ranges is, you know, kind of a more novel or more recent challenge to the department, and with this big, you know, recognition that as we go to more software-based systems and the risk that those systems entail, and that's why we've put a lot of investment and a lot of focus on improving the cyber test capabilities and the tool sets that we have. I think the major thing that needs to happen again is we support the department in this testing. It's a mindset shift, understanding that it's not like we can create these pristine environments that are cyber intrusion free, and that at the edge of the networks and on the edge of the systems, we'll defend our cyber all the way there. There's a much more understanding in the department that we need to be cyber resilient at all times and throughout all our layers. And that's really kind of the, because again, I'm the test environments guy. So mm-hmm. it's not just we need to test this edge network device and make sure that it can't be penetrated. It's a recognition that at any time, at every level, we need to understand the risk that a cyber intrusion could bring to that system. And what can we do to mitigate the significance of a cyber intrusion? I put it akin to a kinetic system where, you know, you don't want an airplane that could get shot down by a single bullet. You want to have an airplane that can land after it's taken a lot of hostile fire, and that plane still flies and that still lands. We look at the cyber attack surface the same way, that we're still able to get our mission done, even though we've may taken a number of cyber attacks while we're getting that mission done.
But are you satisfied with your level in investment on the defensive side of things, right? I mean, that's one of the concerns, is that we've invested maybe a little bit too much in offense and not as much on defense at the end of the day. Are you, as somebody who's not comfortable, as you said earlier, are you comfortable with where you are?
So we have done a shift in priorities into our cyber investments. That's an area of budget investment that we've increased in. And I will say that the department has recognized, just as the department has recognized that we need to shift to our near peer competitors and the challenges that they put on the table. And so there's been a shift in our defense strategy. We've been able to make compelling arguments that investment shifts need to occur as well. In the last, if I back up to our last set of cycles, there's been about a 40% increase in investments in the test infrastructure areas. We're prioritizing that along modernization lines in hypersonics, as well as in cyber. It's one of the areas that is increasing. When you turn around and say, well, is it enough? Well, at the same time, we got to make sure the challenges that I more look at is every one of our major modernization areas kind of bring unique challenges that need to be tackled. Whether it's in hypersonics, it's, you know, dealing with the range of the weapon, the speed of the weapon, the maneuverability of the weapon in a flight test, as well as how do you replicate, you know, Mach 6 plus environments in a ground test facility. So you could actually fly the system on the ground. That's a whole challenge to it. Direct Energy has challenges along the lines of how do I test this weapon and avoid, like, when it comes to high energy lasers, avoid hitting national assets. And so normally we very much limit the scope of what a high energy laser test can look like. And then we ask the question, is that still operationally relevant of a test? Right. When it comes to cyber, the challenge is, It's an extremely dynamic environment. The landscape, the threat landscape changes very, very rapidly. And so we can't have a test infrastructure that lags in the ability to upgrade. It needs to be agile. And so when we talk about our investments, our focus is really the agility of our test range, our cyber test ranges, so that as new threats emerge, we can quickly capture those threats, replicate them in our cyber environment, assess the vulnerabilities of our systems, strategize on how we can patch the systems. And an approach that I always have that we talk about is we're always running both a sprint and a marathon. What are we doing right now that can support our systems that are in the field or near to be fielded? And then also, what's that marathon look as we shoot forward to 2030 and look at that horizon? What investments are we making so that we're prepared as we see these sea shifts? So we're always kind of looking at the here and now, and then also that long-term strategy.
And what are the things in terms of the testing regime that can be done differently, George, to accelerate program speed, right? I mean, at the end of the day, it's the old, every test and evaluator says, hey, I test to the services standards, right? So if you guys tell me it has to have a 97% reliability rate, that's what we test to. What do we have to do as an ecosystem to move through more realistically more honestly and more quickly through test regimes and not end up actually cutting resources for testing, because sometimes we don't stay on top of testing and that causes us downstream problems. What's the way to think about this ecosystem to actually have realistic, honest, thoughtful testing that actually gets us to a better place at the end of the day?
This is where we've kind of taken a page out of the commercial practices of how industry is approaching it in the private sector, that testing shouldn't just be this like graduation exercise, like you take the SAT test. It's really more focused on this continuum of testing. So as you develop your weapon system, what information do you need to know to make design decisions? And that's really your test strategy. That continuous test strategy is the new way forward.
George, thanks so much for all your time. Really appreciate it. It's been an absolute pleasure. It always is a pleasure talking to you. Thanks for joining us and look forward to having you back on again. All the best.
Thank you so much. I look forward to future opportunities to discuss an important topic for the department. Thank you.
And joining us now is Ilan Berman of the American Foreign Policy Council, one of the nation's leading experts on Iran, as well as terrorism, Russia, and a whole bunch of other topics. Ilan, it's always an honor and pleasure having you back on.
Oh, thanks so much for having me back.
So start us off, right? The Biden administration took office saying that they wanted to renegotiate the nuclear deal or at least restart it, that the Trump administration had put the brakes on. EU came through and said, we're willing to negotiate on behalf of the United States and at least open an avenue of communications with the Iranians directly. In the Biden administration, it said, hey, we want to keep sanctions on because I think that we want to broaden the nuclear deal to include ballistic missiles and other issues and try to get to the heart of the bad behavior, using effectively the Trump administration's strong pressure on Iran as leverage. Those sanctions would stay until we change course. The Iranians are now saying that nuclear inspectors cannot get into undisclosed sites. There's a little bit of a debate going on, right? Are the Iranians entitled to say that since the Iran nuclear deal has already been derailed? From your standpoint as an Iran hawk, what are we seeing? What do you want to see? What do we have to see?
Right. Well, let me start with that last part first, because I think it's super important to understand that everything that Iran is doing, and we've discussed this before in previous weeks, but everything that Iran is doing is part of a larger strategy to essentially level the playing field in advance of any negotiations with the Biden administration. So Iranian maritime provocations, Iran sort of inching even further out of the confines of the JCPOA, Iran declaring that it will enrich under certain circumstances, it will enrich uranium up to 60% purity, which has no absolutely no civilian applications. All of this what some have termed provocations on the part of Iran, all of this is part of a strategy by Tehran to build leverage vis-a-vis the Biden administration. And it's something that they're doing, I think, very shrewdly, because they understand that after almost 2 years of the Trump administration's maximum pressure policy, there's a whole lot of economic and political leverage that the new Biden administration can actually apply. There is this sense on the part of the White House that, you know, sanctions are not going to come off immediately. There are some in the Biden orbit that are advocating for preemptive concessions to Iran as a show of good faith, but the White House isn't heading down that route, at least not right now. And so for the Iranians, job number one is to move away from being in a position of weakness into something resembling a position of strength in advance of any discussions with Washington.
And I'm familiar, and I think a lot of people are, that there are people who want the preemptive concessions. But as you said, the president isn't in that camp. It doesn't seem abundantly clear that Tony Blinken or anybody on the National Security Council as such is on that path either. And there are those who say, look, you know, if the Biden administration came to office and said, diplomacy first, we're always willing to talk, but we're also going to hold firm. It looks like the administration's holding pretty tough when it comes to Russia's sanctions, if you want to talk a little bit about that as well. Very, very tough language on China. I mean, in fact, our European allies are a little concerned about how tough this language is. It could this be something where the Biden administration is saying, hey, look, we're always willing to talk, but don't take that the wrong way?
Well, and frankly, it has a lot to do, sort of that position has a lot to do with what else the Biden administration wants to put on the table. Because right. if you look back about a week ago to the president's virtual address before the Munich Security Conference, he made very clear that his first priority was re-entering and renegotiating the nuclear deal with Iran. But immediately afterwards, he said his second priority was curbing Iranian malign behavior in the region. And if history is any judge, the first priority is diametrically opposed to the second, because at least the way the deal was originally negotiated, there was a tremendous amount of direct and indirect economic benefit that accrued to Iran, which set them on a path of regional strategic expansion. So the Biden administration is trying to sort of thread a very tricky needle. It's trying to re-engage with Iran, but trying to do so in a way that doesn't empower even worse Iranian behavior. And the Iranians, I think, understand this very well. And that's why they're being so intransigent and throwing down red lines in terms of what they need to feel comfortable coming back to the negotiating table.
Whether or not the deal is in effect, not in effect, and what the timeline is, at the end of the day, the Iranians are still exhibiting bad behavior, right? There are test sites to which they are not allowing UN inspectors to enter. How does the international community need to respond to this? Because any show of weakness to the Iranians only has a tendency of emboldening greater misbehavior.
No, that's exactly right. And look, the Trump administration was effectively confronted with the same situation that the Biden administration is facing now, which is a series of international allies and indispensable partners, whether it's in the context of Iran, whether it's Europe or negotiating partners that they need to bring on board in the case of Russia and China, that are, frankly, have a vested interest in going back to business as usual with Iran. There's not a lot of appetite in the Eurozone. There's even less appetite in Moscow and Beijing to reestablish an economic sanitary cordon around Iran, to really sort of put Iran back in a box. Because, the prospect of bringing Iran in from the cold, at least economically, is enormously enticing for all of these parties. And so the Biden administration, even though it has, the sort of the sloganeering is that America is back, it's going to confront pretty much the same problem that the Trump administration had, which is that any tightening of restrictions against Iran, any messaging that the United States is considering more stern economic sanctions, is going to be met with a lot of resistance abroad. And the Biden administration has to balance this, has to balance its plan to try to bring Iran to heel, at least in a more inclusive way, with the fact that it's very interested, much more so than its predecessor, in engaging with Europe, in having a sort of a robust transatlantic dialogue. That's not going to be a strategy, frankly, that empowers a more stern Iran policy. It's a strategy that sort of nudges us into a weaker stance vis-a-vis Iran.
But at the end of the day, right, the Trump administration started that, right? I mean, it said, I'm unwinding the deal. There was no evidence that the Iranians were violating anything per the deal, right? They wanted to add a whole bunch of other things to it. And this is, what's it going to take to bring European allies on our side? Because they are, from their standpoint, a little bit exhausted with pitch polling, right? So one of the problems is that they don't fully believe or want to show their own sovereignty vis-a-vis what Washington will do, right? We're Europe. We're going to chart our own course. Thanks very much. After these 4 years, we're not ready to fall in line. What does the administration have to do to make sure that it keeps? What does the administration have to do to make sure that it brings its European allies behind it and keeps them behind it, as opposed to a fractured coalition that actually ends up being counterproductive, doesn't get what you want, while leaving hard feelings behind?
Well, and frankly, this is the $64,000 question. This is what the Secretary of State and the National Security Advisor and all the other principals are wrestling with. Because the reality is that in order to pressure Iran sufficiently to get a longer and stronger deal, it's very likely that we're going to have to apply more economic penalties. And the question here is whether we're going to have to do it unilaterally or do it multilaterally. Obviously, the preference is with the latter, but that's not a foregone conclusion.
Ilan, always an honor and pleasure having you on the program, and look forward to following up with you on the issue of how to get Iran to behave itself. Thanks so very much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And now a word from our sponsor, retired United States Army Major General Jeff Schlosser, who is the Executive Vice President for Strategic Pursuits at Bell.
We've been building creative and innovative aircraft, next generation types of capabilities for almost 9 decades. Bell is the company that can deliver that.
Thanks very much, sir. And thanks to all of you for listening. Please follow our daily podcasts and visit the Defense and Aerospace Report website to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. Follow us on Twitter, like us on Facebook at Defense and Aerospace Report, and check us out on LinkedIn. And stay tuned for our weekly cyber report sponsored by Northrop Grumman. Thanks again to Bell for their generous sponsorship, and we'll see you again tomorrow.